Interview with David Doherty, April 8th, 2010, in Falls Church, Virginia, by Kenneth Durr. Good. Well, let's jump in with your education.
All right.
Where are you from? Where did you go to school?
Well, I grew up in the Berkshires in Massachusetts. And I went to college up in Vermont, St. Michael's College.
Okay.
Had a lot of fun up there, skiing and doing all the cold winter sports. Then I came down to Washington to Georgetown Law School in 1962 and graduated from Georgetown in 1965. And at that point, I went directly to the SEC in the Washington Regional Office, which at that time was in sort of a shabby old building on, I think, 6th Street, more or less a few blocks from the Georgetown Law School, which actually was the site of the SEC building just before the new building. It was on the same site, so it was close to the law school.
Did you have a professor at Georgetown who steered you toward the SEC?
No, not particularly. I just had taken some courses and found the securities laws interesting, and I thought I would give it a try. And Alex Brown was there at the time. He was the administrator, and so I worked there for a few years, starting at the grand salary, I recall, of $6,030 a year. we moved a few times. We moved from there out to Crystal City, and then we moved over to Ballston.
What kind of work did a young lawyer do for the Washington Regional
Office? Well, we did a lot of fun stuff. The regions, of course, really at that time, Stanley was just starting to build the national enforcement program. So the regions really were the first line and would do everything really that was required. They'd go out and do the inspections, and if there were problems with the firm, then we would do. I was in the enforcement program and. Then we would bring the cases that were the net capital rules or whatever. But we had some very interesting cases. I know I, as a young lawyer, went up to New York and tried a case against three over-the-counter broker-dealers who we alleged were manipulating a variety of stocks in the pink sheets, the old pink sheets. Mm-hmm. And that was really quite an interesting case. And I got up there with a couple of years of experience under my belt and was met with 10 fancy lawyers, Milton Gould and all of some of New York's finest. And we really had a knockdown, drag-out fight for several weeks. And that was appealed to the commission, and we won, and so on. So that was an exciting time. But we really did everything. We looked at the fraud cases, the market cases, the financial and operational type problems with the firms. We were out with some of the old sales practice things out in West Virginia interviewing customers out there who had been the victim of some local brokerage firm that overreached and so on. So we had a wide variety of kinds of things.
How did you end up in New York City dealing with these fancy lawyers since you're down here in Washington?
Well, because at least two of the three over-the-counter firms, and remember it was Allison Drini & Co. and Boudin & Co., I'm sure they're not around anymore, were located in New York City. Okay. So it was an administrative proceeding, and we brought the charges, and that was the location. But we really dealt with anything and everything.
The general enforcement types.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. No, I was on the enforcement side, so I was doing enforcement work. And
how did you end up on the enforcement side?
That was my interest. I was a lawyer, and I wanted to sort of investigate and try cases. And so that was the slot that I went into at the regional office.
So who was running the regional office at this point?
Alex Brown. He had been around for since the beginning of time.
Okay.
And he was quite a character. And he ran the office for many years. I transferred after 3 years or so over to headquarters. Mm-hmm. And he ran the office for some time after that, and then he retired.
Why were you interested in transferring to headquarters?
Well, I thought that that's where the action was. I mean, the big action. I could see that Stan Sporkin was starting his... It was in the process and had really begun really establishing a national enforcement program. And he was bringing resources in, and it was clear to me that he was looking for the trends and the big emerging cases. And he also, at that time, since we were getting into bigger cases and all, decided that that the headquarters should start a trial unit. Mm. Because we were trying cases and we were coming up against more and more of the high-powered outside firms, he felt we had to develop a real internal expertise with a unit dedicated exclusively to trying the tough cases. And so my initial, since I had, in my 3 years at the Washington Regional Office, had ended up trying two or three cases, he said, I had reached out, and he said, sure, come on over, you can work with Bob LaPrade. And Bob, whom you may know, was a very senior fellow there and had tried a lot of cases. So I was going to work with Bob, and we were sort of the beginning, the core of the trial unit.
How did that work out?
Well, it worked fine. We started doing some cases, and then the next thing I knew, a branch chief position came open, and Stanley said, would you like to do that? I would like you to, if you would, and I did that. And then from there, I became an assistant director and associate director.
Okay. So what was the branch chief position? What was your portfolio there?
The branch chief position that I initially had, interestingly, was the organized crime branch. At the time, we no longer have such a branch, but at the time it was, we felt we needed some expertise in that area. There were a number of public companies that had bought casinos, and there was a good bit of shenanigans going on in that area. And so we had this branch that was had an expertise in that area. We established relationships with the Nevada Gaming Commission, and we went out and toured casinos. And this was the branch also that had the strongest liaison with the Justice Department dealing with the criminal matters.
Okay.
So that was our focus, but we also did other things as well. I mean, we also dealt with the general matters that were on the commission's plate.
Might there be issues of broker dealers involved with organized crime?
Oh, yes. Like yeah. There could well be that. And
so did you work on some notable cases?
Well, I'm trying to recall some of the names. I know there was one case we brought, and I don't recall the name of it, but it was really kind of shocking because the head of the public company that was primarily principal asset was the casino, had managed to siphon funds from the company and fund one of his real estate ventures. And this had been approved by the board, which wasn't much of an independent board. And so I know he brought a case there and got some significant relief.
And you, I suppose you worked with Justice on that, federal prosecutor.
No, that was that initially was our case. And I don't think Justice took an interest in that one. Hmm. But we did work on a lot of cases with Justice. One very interesting case, I think, and it wasn't particularly organized crime, but one of the cases I thought was kind of illustrated what we tried to do over there. You know, as I said, the regions really were kind of flat out dealing with all of the matters that they had to deal with. They didn't have a lot of discretion as to whether they'd bring the net capital case or not. If they had the resources, they would do it. Mm-hmm. And part of Stanley's theory in building the national program was to have something resembling a reserve squad, that you'd kind of sit back, you'd try to see the problems developing, and as you saw them, you would throw a lot of resources at it, try to get ahead of it, and try to fix the problem mm-hmm. before it developed into a too big a problem. So we were trying not to be completely reactive, which enforcement is fundamentally reactive, but we were trying to not do that as much as possible. And so there was a case, we started getting complaints in the early to mid-70s, a series of complaints out of the South, the Memphis area, about dealers down there selling municipal bonds and overreaching customers. Now, the commission really had virtually no experience with municipal bonds. They are exempt from registration for sale, certainly. And at the time, dealers who dealt exclusively in municipal bonds were exempt from any regulatory jurisdiction of the commission. So we went down and, again, threw resources at it. We conducted several quick investigations into various different firms. And we found just classic boiler room stuff. Right. I mean, it was, you know, selling high-pressure sales tactics, untrained employees, selling marginal quality municipal bonds to little old ladies and buying them one day for 50 and selling them the next day for 100. I mean, the markups were absolutely shocking. The whole situation was shocking. So I went down to file my charges in federal court down there. And as our custom, I stopped in to brief the local U.S. attorney in Memphis. And that was always our practice because, for all intents and purposes, the U.S. attorneys do represent the federal government in right. court. And it's very much the exception that the SEC can go in and file its own lawsuit. So as a courtesy, we would stop in and brief them. So I stopped in to brief the U.S. attorney and told him about these outrageous markups and all this overreaching. And he said to me, "Son, you don't have a case here." He said, "You know, selling municipal bonds is just like selling used cars. You sell them for as much as you can get." So despite that admonition, I went ahead and filed the case anyway. And And we tried the case. We actually tried the case. And we won. And we got a great decision.
Now, even though these are municipal bonds and they're mm-hmm. not subject to SEC regulation, how was it that you could go in and do this?
10b-5. Okay. And, you know, that was one of the issues that the defendants claimed, that, you know, securities laws don't apply to municipal bonds. And our view was that, you know, you may not be regulated by the exchange. They may not be registered for sale, but 10b-5 is 10b-5, and they're a security. And if there's fraud, that's 10b-5. And the court held that, and we prevailed. It was a very good decision. We brought a couple more quick cases in that area, and then we went to Congress and said, you know, look at the record that we have established of this abuse. And Congress, at our request, amended the securities law and required these dealers to be registered as broker-dealers.
Did that go into the 75 Act amendments?
I believe it did. Okay. I believe it did.
And so when you say you took it to Congress, how does that work? Does it give it to the commission?
We would go to the commission and say, here's the record of abuse that we've established, and we would recommend that the commission go to Congress and recommend that amendment be passed to regulate these dealers. And we did, and Congress agreed, and the problem went away. So I think that's a good example of how we would try to get ahead of a new and growing problem and then try to fix it. And we did fix it that time. The division then was much smaller. You know, this is in the late 70s. I think Stanley left in about 1980. But right about then, there were only three associate directors. There was myself, and I ran about half the division, and Ted Levine kind of ran the other half, and Ted Soundy was the third associate, and he ran the trial unit. So, okay. You know, that was pretty much the program. And I would say there were somewhere between 150 and 200 people in the entire enforcement division at that time.
One of the things that's coming in must have been, at least from an outsider's perspective, was the whole foreign corrupt payments thing.
Right.
Seemed, you know, from an observer's point of view, seemed to take over enforcement big time in the late 70s.
Well, that was it would be an understatement to say that it was a major program in the division. And it was very exciting. I recall discussing with my colleagues in the division at one point that the only person in the management of the division at that time that was over 40 was Stanley. It was a very, very young group, and we were all very excited and wearing the white hats and doing good and all that, and Stanley was a great leader, so it was an exciting time. And the foreign payments cases were, clearly we were breaking new ground, developing theories as to how this sort of conduct, if this major corporation has this off-the-books slush fund to make foreign payments or political contributions or whatever they might have been. You know, why does that violate federal securities laws from an accounting and purely economic point of view? The little slush funds were minuscule compared to assets and so on. We kind of had this theory that, well, it reflects on the integrity of management, it reflects on the integrity of the books and records, and it reflects on the quality of the of the company's business. I mean, who knows what kind of business they would have if they weren't bribing foreign officials. And, you know, there's always a risk dimension to it as well. If that's how you get business, maybe it could disappear quickly. So these theories really kind of developed over time as we found different cases. And the commission initially didn't seem too thrilled about them, but you know, over time, I think they really did come to believe in the program and authorize the cases. I mean, you can't go to court if the commission doesn't authorize you to go to court. So, but Stanley had to argue pretty hard sometimes at the table to get authorization to proceed. But it, you know, I think it was a good program. A lot of corporate America were was mad at the SEC.
How did this work out? I mean, did your group handle a lot of them, or did Ted Levine's group, or how did you divide that up?
I probably had more than Ted, but there were so many that you know, they really got spread around. But, you know, it was a very hot topic. You know, it was all the PLI programs, and everyone was discussing it. And then, of course, then you had all the sub-issues that were involved, such as, well, you know, is the name of the foreign official that got bribed a material fact to be disclosed in the complaint, and so on. So there were a whole kind of series of sub-issues as to what aspect of all of this is material in terms of 10b-5. And
do you remember the first case you got involved in?
It could have been Gulf Oil, but there were so many. I mean, and the luminaries that would come in to represent these companies were all very impressive. You know, Clark Clifford was in, Abe Fortas, Bill Rogers, you know, former Secretary of State. And, you know, it was just a pretty exciting time dealing with all of these guys.
They must have been a little put off to have to come in and talk to you below under 40.
Well, times. Now I have mentioned a number of times, I always thought it was interesting, Clark Clifford, who I guess at the time I was either an assistant or an associate by the time we get into these cases, but Clark Clifford, whenever he came in, he would be the nicest to the junior attorney on the case, which was smart, you know, because, you know, the junior attorney, you know, writes up things and he investigates things, and he, you know, he or she have a lot of influence over, you know, the development of a case, even if it's relatively closely supervised. And I just used to marvel and kind of admire his approach, because he would be so nice to that junior attorney on the case, and, you know, they would be impressed by that. And then others had a different style. They thought, why do I want to talk to you? I want to talk to the director.
Yeah.
But that's not a smart approach.
Right. Because you're doing all the work.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
How did you talked about the reception? It took the commission a while to get used to the idea. Was the commission split? Was it a matter of
it wasn't a political thing at all. I don't think. I think they were just trying to do the right thing. I think they were just struggling with, you know, course of conduct that everyone was put off by, but struggling to see whether it was the securities laws that were the right way to, you know, address the problem and whether they fit. And, you know, I think it wasn't long till they came around to believing that that was the right thing to do.
One of the cases having to do something in that area anyway that I came across had to do with Citibank.
Citibank, yes, I remember Citibank.
Which appears to have had a very complicated run through. Can you tell me?
Yeah, Citibank, it's back a couple of years. Yeah. Citibank had engaged in practices, as I recall, that that resulted in their avoiding foreign taxes. So it wasn't it wasn't your typical foreign payoff. It was kind of a tax dodge effort, we felt, in enforcement. We had started the case while Stanley was there, and he went off to the CIA. And so I was running the case after he left. John Fetters was the director after Stanley. But we believe the theories as to why this was a violation were pretty much the same theories that we believe the foreign payoff cases were violations as well, affected the books and records and so on. And we actually worked out a settlement with Citigroup, and that, you know, they had agreed tentatively to settle. I don't recall the terms of it now, but we had a deal, and we went to the commission with it, and John Fetters did not support it, and I knew he didn't support it.
Did you know that was going to be the case when you took this thing in?
Yes, I knew that. I said, here's the case, we got a deal. I think we ought to send it up anyway. I understand you don't agree, but I think we ought to send it up anyway and let the commissioner decide. So he agreed.
Okay.
And we sent it up, and the commission rejected. And there had been, I think it all started with a whistleblower in Citigroup, Citicorp, and somehow he had reached out to Congress. And so once the commission rejected it, Congress then called for hearings. And they had hearings on the issue, and I went up to testify. Stanley went up to testify. I got a fair bit of notoriety, and that Congress was of the view, at least you got the sense they were of the view that a case should have been brought, and so the commission got a little bit of bad press from the Congress at the time, but the case wasn't. But the commission's concern was it's just not economically material. You know, whatever this was, maybe it was $30 million or something.
Right.
And
this comes at an important time too, though. Because apparently the case would have been started under Harold Williams or in the late 70s,
right.
And then John Shad and Fetters come in, and there was a remarked upon sort of change in outlook at the commission. Was that part of what was going on here?
That could have been part of it. Yeah, I think they, you know, John Shadd, I liked very much. I liked John. He came from the street, as I recall. And he was a lawyer, but I don't think he'd ever practiced law. And but I do, and he, it was tough to convince him to charge a company, particularly a Wall Street firm. He seemed to have the view that people do these things, so you ought to charge people. And, you know, there's logic to that. But I do think that he always did what he thought was the right thing to do. You know, he wasn't trying to shut down enforcement. He wasn't trying to get in bed with the street. He just had kind of a different view, and you could convince him sometimes.
Okay.
So I think he was a fine guy. He just had a more conservative view on these things, and he would sometimes say, "Well, I think, you know, why do we have the expertise to go in and tell a Wall Street firm how to run its business?" You know,
right?
Say, "Well, you know, we." You know, we mandate what books and records they keep. We regulate them. We do know a lot about them and so on. So, but he had that point of view. But he did what he thought was the right thing to do, I think. Yeah.
You talked about earlier on, mid to late 60s, 70s, early 70s, I guess, this idea that in the enforcement, the headquarters enforcement was going to be the shock troops, somebody you could send in. And clearly they developed that when it came to the foreign corrupt payment stuff. How did that work out in other areas?
Well, let me think what other... I know Ted Levine got into a lot of the takeover cases. That was another area, I think, that we get into, and that was an area he had... he dealt more with. We got into a lot of cases, you know, Stanley had this access theory, which was, you know, there are certain important players that really have control over access to the marketplace, and that we should hold those players to a high degree of accountability. And those were the, you know, the certainly the underwriters, you know, the member firms and the accountants and the lawyers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there were efforts in that area. I know we brought cases that would deal in those. I'm trying to recall other, but those would be the kinds of things that, that we would look for and try to deal with.
Okay. National Student Marketing was
one of the big.
Was that
Ted Sondy? Ted Sondy did that case.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else that we should touch on from your time in enforcement?
I think those are the, you know, those are the highlights.
Okay.
I think it was great working with, you know, Stanley and Irv Pollack before him. We did have, as the headquarters enforcement program grew, there did develop the tension that you might expect with the regional offices that had always been the front line for the enforcement work. And initially, the regional directors reported directly to the chairman. They didn't report through enforcement. And so they felt that, you know, they didn't work for the headquarters enforcement division, and that if there was a case that came along that they wanted to do, they felt that they were entitled to do it. And then, so there was this tension, and there still is to some degree, I think. It's just the nature of it. Everybody wants the big case and the hot case and so on. But overall, I think that was managed pretty well. We would work closely with the region. Sometimes we do a case together and so on. So there never was any real open rebellion about it. And eventually, as I recall, the exchange was, the commission was structured so that the regional directors reported through the director of enforcement, at least for purpose of enforcement matters. And one of the jobs I had as an assistant director at headquarters was to review all of the regional matters, regional enforcement matters that came in to the commission. So I had a unit that would review any enforcement matter that came in. And, you know, we would have a dialogue with the regions. And I would usually go to the table to present the regional office cases to the commission. If there was a major one or one that was controversial, we would bring in the regional office people to, you know, represent their own case at the commission.
Would you ever take a look at this and go back to the region and say, hey, what about this? Maybe.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, we, there was a lot of dialogue, and, you know, it wasn't just a matter of being sure it was written clearly or something. You know, we did a substantive review, and we would have a dialogue with them and recommend certain things. And that worked out well because they knew we were trying to help them. You know, we weren't trying to get in their way. We were trying to be helpful. So, and that unit, I'm sure, is still there because it, you know, played a valuable role. And we would go out and visit the regions and be sure they were up to speed on policy and so on. So,
I suppose there was a lot you could learn from the regions.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no question. I mean, they were the guys that are out there, you know, in the brokerage firms doing their reviews and checking books. You know, they knew that stuff, you know. And so, oh, yeah, we learned from them, and also they were good sources of information as well. So we had a good, you know, a good relationship with the regions.
Okay. Most of the time I'm looking at folks who have gone through with the SEC, mostly in their younger years, and they go off to a big law firm or something like that, or Wall Street. You took a different path. I wonder if Stanley Sporkin had anything to do with the CIA connection.
Well, he did. I mean, he had, Bill Casey had asked him to come over and be general counsel. I stayed on for a year and a half, maybe after that. And then I decided that I was going to leave. And but I wasn't interested in going to law firm. I mean, that never piqued my interest. I was basically wanted to do something that was interesting and worthwhile. And around that same time, Stanley called to say, hey, you know, I'd love to have you come over here if you're thinking about making a move. And, you know, we've got a good spot for you, and I'm sure you could do great, and so on. So,
so what was the spot exactly?
It was an associate general counsel. there were a few associates. There was a deputy, but, you know, the deputy was not so much a substantive deputy as he administered mm-hmm. things as well. But I, you know, was basically dealing with the spy guys.
Right.
Yeah.
There must have been quite a learning curve.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a whole different world. A whole different world. But they have a really talented group of people in the office there, in the legal staff. And, but it's, as I say, a whole different world. You just deal with... It made the SEC's jurisdiction seem so narrow. So we were dealing with, you know, any issue you could imagine, including whether, you know, the president has to sign a piece of paper to authorize somebody to do something. And big deal stuff.
Yeah.
Some routine, but a lot of big deal stuff.
So how long did you stay with that?
Well, I was... the associate for a couple of years, and then Stanley became a judge, and then Bill Casey asked me if I would be general counsel. So I was general counsel for a couple more years, and then I went from the world of no disclosure, if you can help it, back to the world of full disclosure.
Right.
But that was exciting. It's the best legal job in the federal government.
Yeah, the CIA.
If you don't mind craziness.
Yeah. Huh. Did it, was it, you didn't stay too long though. I mean, was it the challenge or?
Well, no, I mean, it's when you become so senior, you know, in the government as a general, I knew when I took the general counsel's job that, you know, I would move on after a couple of years, and it's not a career position. You know? I mean, maybe you could make it that way, but it seems when administrations change and so on that people want their own general counsel,
right.
Understandably, I think.
Right.
So I knew I would move on in a couple of years.
Did anything in particular precipitate your move to the exchange?
I was, again, at the point where I thought, well, it's time to start thinking about making a move, and they reached out to me. One of the people that I had worked with at the SEC had gone to the exchange to head their examination program. And
who was that?
That was Ed Qualwasser.
Okay, sure.
And the exchange's enforcement director at that time had left, and so he reached out to me and asked whether I would be interested in coming up, and I thought, well, sounds interesting, you know, might be fun to live in New York for a while, and stock exchange has always been had a good reputation, and thought it might be fun, talked to my wife, and she said, hey, that might be fun. So we did it. Actually, at the same time, Jim Clarkson had called me, and because the regional office in New York had opened up as well. The director had gone, so he said, come up and be my... I said, I don't think I could move to New York on... not a government salary, Jim. So,
how much did you know? How much did you know about the stock exchange? I mean, granted, you'd worked in the SEC, but this is you know, the nature of this job is pretty different.
Well, I knew, you know, a fair bit about it, and I knew it was an SRO, and I knew kind of the dynamics of an SRO and how that worked. And I was very concerned going up there that I wanted to be able to run a tough program and make the kinds of calls that I needed to make, and I had no interest in going up there and being shut down in terms of trying to get the job done. And I was assured that I could build the kind of program that I thought needed to be built. They were prepared to, the SEC had kind of come down hard on them, I think in the late 80s. And so they wanted to build a program that did the job.
Who gave you the assurances? Who were you talking to?
First I talked to Ed. Of course, he was, I can explain to you how it was built, but he was, at the time, the regulatory program has three main departments. His was the member firm regulation, and then there's market surveillance, and then there's enforcement.
Right.
So he was head of the member firm department at that point. But I talked to John Fallon. He was the chairman at the time, extensively, and he assured me that, he was going to give me the budget and I'd be able to build the kind of program that I needed to build to get the job done.
That gets to the question of what did you want to change? What did you want to build that was new or different somehow?
Well, the exchange had not had a reputation for, particularly in the enforcement era, had not had a reputation as being a vigorous enforcer. I think the member firm regulation division was pretty well regarded. The folks that go out and do the exams, and they're mostly accountants over there and examiners. All that stuff. And then they do the sales practice, and it's the largest regulatory unit. But enforcement had just gotten kind of hit by the SEC for not doing a very good job. So the exchange was prepared to step up to the plate and do it. So, I wanted to get up there and show them that we could really bring the big cases against the important member firms, and we weren't going to shy away from doing that. And we did. So,
why do you think that the enforcement had shied away from doing that in the past?
Well,
You must have experienced some of the pressures and seen how the system
works. It's a self-regulatory organization, and there are conflicts inherent in that. I mean, you have an exchange that has member firms, and they want to do business and make money, and then you have the regulators housed in the same organization who are a cost center and from time to time come along and say to their important member organizations, we think you're violating the law and we're going to sue you and we're going to fine you and we're going to publish it and make you look bad. And so you then get into who's going to get their way. And I think it was about 15 years ago, the SEC Oversight Group brought a case against the NESD and concluded that the NESD was allowing the interests of the members to override the interests of the public. Mm-hmm. And they pointed to several things in the structure of the NESD that they required to be changed. One was that the NASD was virtually, their board was virtually all members. Okay. And another was that the in order for the regulatory people at the NASD to bring a charge against anyone, they had to go to a committee that was comprised of all industry people and get permission. And then when they did have a hearing, it would go before a hearing panel that was also composed of all industry people. And the SEC said, you know, that's a lousy system. You know, that doesn't permit the regulatory people to do what they need to do. And they made them change it. Our system at the exchange at that time didn't resemble that. Our board of directors were 50% public investors.
That was when you got there? That's the way
when I got there, right, when I got there. And our hearing panels were three-member hearing panels, two industry members, but a professional lawyer, judge, hearing panelist who ran these things that was independent from us and independent from the industry. They're, you know, they work for the exchange, but they were appointed. And they could be objective. And on the issue of whether or not we could bring a case, file a charge, that was determined solely within the regulatory group. So we didn't have those issues. So we had a structure that permitted us to do our job.
Okay.
Now, you have to add to that, you know, in order for the SRO concept to work, I think you have to add, you know, a competent, vigorous staff that's going to get resources, and then you have to have the structure that I just mentioned. And if you have that, I think, and it's coupled with vigorous oversight by the SEC, I think that's an important component, because the SRO needs to understand that the SEC's looking to be sure that they're fulfilling their self-regulatory responsibilities, which is to enforce the 34 Act and their own rules against their members and associated. But if you get all those components together, I think the SRO model works well, and you can deal with the, you know, the inherent conflicts that are involved. And, you know, in some ways, I think an SRO can do the job better than the SEC, and there's value to them there. One of the principal values is that, and the SEC has even acknowledged this in various things, I think maybe the NASD suit I mentioned, but they saw three advantages to an SRO. One is that the self-regulators are really the local cops on the beat. They're right there. They have a feel for what's going on. They can react quickly and so on. The other big advantage is they supplement the resources of the government. I mean, we had, when I left, we had in regulation something like 560 people devoted exclusively to regulation. That's about a third of the entire staff of the exchange, with a budget of over $140 million and doing the kind of work that the SEC or someone else would have to do had we not done. And the other big advantage of an SRO, and I think it's missed a lot, is that we not only enforce, you know, the 34 Act against them, but we have ethical rules. Conduct inconsistent with just and equitable principles of trade, and acts detrimental, and failure to adhere to the principles of good business practice, and so on. And that permits us to reach misconduct that the SEC cannot reach under the federal securities laws, and conduct that should be redressed sometimes. So that's a big advantage.
Give me an example of that.
Well, one simple advantage is if you have a back office clerk who steals money from another back office clerk or steals his credit card or something, the SEC can't do anything about that. There's no securities transaction involved there. But I think one of, and, you know, there are a number of cases. We brought a manipulation case against a firm, and we charged 10b-5 and conduct inconsistent, said the firm manipulated the market. And it was appealed to the SEC, and the SEC said, now, it's not 10b-5 because the exchange did not prove scienter. So without scienter, there's no 10b-5. But they said, but surely it's conduct inconsistent. Right? So, you know, again, it's a case where we could, the commission was saying this might be a manipulation, but it's not something you can reach through 10b-5, right. But it is of such ethical concern that we would think it is a violation of the exchanger's rule against conduct inconsistent with just equitable principles of trade. So that's an example.
Right. So in this case, you found a firm that was doing some manipulation, and you know, so you're going to apply this conduct inconsistent thing,
right,
which is sort of the exchange. They used to make a big deal of this way back when, the idea that they have the power to basically do anything they want to do to, you know. What would the next step be then? You're not really working with the SEC because that's out of their bailiwick. Does that go to the exchange board, or how does that work?
Oh, and you mean in terms of a disciplinary proceeding?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe I should take you through how an...
That would be great.
Give you a little background. That might make sense. But just before I do that, let me give you another example of the conduct inconsistent. Just before I left, we, along with the SEC and the NASD and the states and everyone, brought this big research analyst case, which, you know, involved all, you know, virtually all of the major member firms. And the fundamental problem was that there was a conflict of interest, that the investment banking part of the firm unduly influenced the research analysts in the research they produced. And, you know, conflicts abound everywhere. The SEC has potential conflicts. They investigate cases, they prosecute cases, and they're the judge on the cases that they investigate and prosecute. But they take steps to manage the conflict so that it makes sense. And the fundamental allegation on these research analyst cases is that, yes, there was this, clearly, you know, you have investment analysts, investment banking, and you have research analysts, so they're not going to, you know, see things the same way.
Right.
And so there's a potential conflict, but as a business operation, you have to take reasonable steps to manage that conflict so that you run your operation in a fair and sensible way. And so that was the fundamental allegation in those cases, where we generated over $1 billion in payments and so on. And the allegation that applied to that particular conduct was not the federal securities laws. That was conduct inconsistent. That was our ethical rules. Now, there were a sprinkling of other cases other conduct that involved a particular SEC rule. But the fundamental charge in those cases was conduct inconsistent, or one of our ethical rules. Now, the SEC can charge that as well in a joint case. as we did here.
So they can support the your charge.
Yes, yes, and they can include it in their charge, but I don't think they could include it independent. The only way they could really traditionally have ever included an SRO charge in a SEC enforcement action is basically when the SRO refused to bring the charge. You know, mm-hmm. Then they could bring it.
How about the NASD? Did they have a similar
thing? Yeah, they have a similar. And they were part of this as well. And they have a rule, an ethical rule as well, that is comparable to ours. But it's something I think a lot of people are missing. The fundamental charge in that case that enabled us to reach what we reached was the conduct and our ethical rules. Because we didn't say that, and we didn't charge that all of this stuff spawned fraud. You know, that wasn't, it was the conflict that was not adequately managed. It was the fundamental charge. Okay, so do you want me to kind of explain to you how the division,
how the process worked? Yeah, I think that would be terrific.
Well, first, in terms of staffing, over the time I was there, we doubled or tripled the staff, and we at least tripled the number of enforcement cases that we brought. We were bringing in the vicinity of 200 or more enforcement cases a year. We had a very experienced staff. I got a lot of people from the SEC. I got a lot of people from outside law firms, a lot of people from DA's offices. So, you know, I had about 140 people, and they were virtually all lawyers, and with an average of over a dozen years of legal experience. So it was a different makeup in terms of from the SEC kind of staff. And I had complete support. Nobody interfered with what I needed to do in the cases I felt I needed to bring. So let me give you how the regulatory group was set up. There were over 500 people by the time I left, three basic divisions. There's the member firm regulation division, there are the accountants, the largest group. There were probably 250 of them. And they go out and do periodic exams of the member firms, and they go in and look at all the financial and operational compliance issues, and they go in and look for sales practice issues. And, they're an experienced, able group and well-recognized by the SEC, I think, for doing a good job. We then have a market surveillance group. There were probably 125 of them, analysts and investigators. And their job was to kind of surveil the trading activity on the floor. And they have computers, and every stock has an historical fingerprint, and it's monitored on a real-time basis in terms of its volume and price and volatility and so on. And if something kicks out, then they say, gee, you know, why did that happen? Did they make an announcement? If not, then they'll do preliminary inquiries and so on.
This must have been getting more and more sophisticated.
Oh, yes. The exchange pumped many millions of dollars into the technology on the floor. And so they would, they looked at floor compliance, manipulations, market activities, and so on. And then we have the enforcement division. We had about 140 people, mostly lawyers, experience group, and so on. We would get our cases. We got cases from outside sources, and customers would complain and so on. The member firms are required to make filings with the exchange when certain events occur, like they settle a case with a customer over a certain amount of money, or they fire a salesman for cause, and they have to make filings. And we also get a lot of cases from our other divisions. Examiners would send cases. The market surveillance people would send cases. We get a few from the SEC. We read newspapers and so on. But we would open We carried an inventory of about 700 cases. And we would open and process about 500 cases a year. We'd bring a couple of hundred enforcement actions a year. Our investigations were like the SEC's in a lot of ways, and not like the SEC's in a lot of ways. Now, we would both go out. We would go out to get the facts, interview witnesses, you request documents from firms, took a lot of investigative testimony, 700 or 800 depositions a year. But the SEC's jurisdiction is much broader than ours. You know, we're limited to member firms and people associated. So, but the SEC isn't. So, and they have subpoena power, and we didn't. So there were some cases that we just could not do well because of our limited jurisdiction. Some cases, for instance, let's say an insider case that involved a lot of public company executives and lawyers and bankers and so on, you know, we can't.
There's no member firms involved.
Right. We couldn't, well, even if they were involved, we could only compel the member firms to do things, and the others we would have to say, hey, will you come in and talk to us?
Right.
And if they got anything, if they have any involvement, they're going to say, take a hike.
Right.
So that kind of a case, we would refer to the SEC. So a lot of market surveillance insider trading cases that they picked up got referred down to the SEC. We did a lot, too, but, you know, some of them we just couldn't do. So they have that broader jurisdiction and subpoena power. We didn't have subpoena power, but with respect to our member firms and people associated, we had something better, which was we have a rule that says you have to comply with our requests. And if they don't comply with our requests, the usual process is we'd bring an enforcement action and they would get thrown out of the business. So it's a, you know, pretty substantial tool. And it was our view that assertion of the Fifth Amendment privilege was not an acceptable position to take when we requested information. And the cases support that. You know, we say you take the Fifth and you're out of the business. And the reason for that is, you know, we do have limited jurisdiction. In one sense, we already have one hand tied behind our back since we don't have subpoena power and we can't go wide. And if you want to be in the business, then, you know, you need to testify if we ask for information. And even the member firms even support that. They don't want their people to not be able to do that and not cooperate investigations.
And this is the nature of a member organization that
That's
you
right.
can do that.
That's right.
Yeah.
We also held the view, and the cases support it, that our investigations are not subject to statute of limitations. Now, a number of SEC, certain categories, I guess, of SEC cases do have a 5-year statute of limitations. It has been our view and policy that first, there is no existing statute of limitations that applies to SROs, and we're not the government, so whatever case law there was doesn't apply to us. And the policy behind it, I think, is really sound. These people are not just your typical man on the street, like the SEC, but, you know, these are people who are licensed, they're fiduciaries, they're licensed to deal with customers' funds and securities. And, you know, if a salesman steals money from his customer's account and we don't find out about it till 6 years later, it's still not okay. I mean, the issue really is fitness, you know, are they fit to continue in the business? And so we hold the view that that person is not fit, even if it is 6-7 years old. That said, we don't like old cases. You know, we prioritize the more current ones and so on. But if a case needs to be brought, you know, we're prepared. We're prepared to bring it. So that kind of are some differences between our investigations mm-hmm. and SEC investigations. When we complete an investigation, we then make a determination as to whether there's a violation and whether it's sensible to bring a case and what kind of a case should be brought. That decision, as I said, is made completely within the regulatory group. And then we, at that point, either file our case or we have a process much like the SEC's where they kind of go through this Wells process. We go back to the person or the firm as a general matter and say, all right, we're going to bring the case. This is what we see. This is what we think you've done. Shall we file a case or do you want to talk about trying to resolve it? So we go through that process.
How often would they want to resolve it?
we resolved, I would say we tried about 25% of our cases.
Okay.
It was probably a higher percentage than the SEC used to try.
So 75% of the time they'd say, yeah, okay.
Yeah, most of the time you work out a settlement. I mean, it's, you'd grind to a halt if you had to try every case. But we have our enforcement cases are done through an administrative disciplinary panel that's within the exchange.
Okay.
It's very comparable to the SEC's administrative proceeding. Again, we have the law judge and two peers. Assuming it's a contested case, we file our charges, the respondents. Answer, we have pretrial motions, we have a trial, call witnesses, take testimony. And, you know, the hearing officers have some discretion, they rule on evidence and so on, but basically the rules of evidence pretty much apply. And they then will render a decision. It's published. It can be appealed to the board of directors
of the exchange
and really comparable to an appeal to the commission, and they're then in the appeal is basically an oral argument. You don't have another trial. You appear before the board or a committee of the board and argue your case as the SEC does before the commission. And then the board issues a decision. And then that decision can be appealed to the Court of Appeals and ultimately to the Supreme Court, theoretically.
Okay.
And the decisions are, you know, when final, they're published in public.
How often would somebody get to the board, and how often would the board go against something you had been decided lower down?
On a contested case, it wouldn't be unusual for someone to appeal to the board. It would be unusual. Oh, I think I skipped a step. From the exchange's board of directors, the appeal goes to the SEC.
Okay.
And then to the Court of Appeals.
Okay.
So it wouldn't be unusual for someone to appeal to the board from a contested proceeding. And the board, assuming it was, you know, a well-reasoned decision and so on, generally would affirm the hearing, although there were occasions when we would appeal a hearing panel decision to the board. And, you know, there were a few occasions where we got it reversed as well. So it's it's a pretty good process. It works reasonably well. Now, on a settlement, which happens, as I said, probably 75% of the time, that also is submitted to the hearing panel. And they need to approve the settlement. And it's unusual if they tinker with it at all. But it does have to go through that process. So there's a hearing panel involved in every formal disciplinary proceeding.
Okay. That your clarification answers a question, because I'd noticed some instances in which the SEC seemed to sort of overturn what the exchange had done mm-hmm. in a disciplinary case.
Yes. Yes.
Which seems really curious.
Yeah, kind of they like. Can do that. I mean, there was one case, and I'm still scratching my head about it because it would sometimes just come out of left field, but we had brought a case that was old, and it was old. There was a reason for it to be old because we learned about it late, but then you can always do things faster as well. But, you know, we had a substantial trial on it, and the fellow was did some bad things. And it went to the commission, and they just reversed it and said that it was too old. They didn't say the statute of limitations had run or anything. I guess they just thought it was too old. It wasn't a model of legal clarity, but then I sort of was commiserating with the SEC's enforcement director at the time, and he says, "Oh, they've done it to me too." You know, so but anyway, yeah, I mean, it can. You know, commission, they're independent. And,
so had resources been an issue at any point? It sounds to me like, you know, you got most of what you needed in order to...
Yeah, yeah. You're never going to find a enforcement person who's going to say, I have more resources than I can use, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just not going to happen. But no, I mean, the exchange was very supportive of the enforcement program. You know, they get a bad rap, I think, a lot, but I found them very supportive. We got resources. We had no interference with cases we wanted to bring. No subtle pressure. No bathroom talk saying, you know, it just wasn't there. And we really, you know, built the program. I'm very proud of the program we built and supportive. You know, we were in the world. The exchange's enforcement division was housed in the World Trade Center. We had 65,000 feet there on the 28th, 29th, and 30th floor, and so we were. Most of us were there that fateful day, and fortunately, we all. Get out of there. But, you know, everything was vaporized. Everything you had in your office for 15 or so, all your professional stuff, everything and all your case files, it was just vaporized, it was gone. And, you know, the exchange was terrific. Within 2 weeks, we had temporary space and 20 Broad Street next to the exchange, you know, where rows of tables and so on, but, you know, we all had computers and we had things we needed to keep operating.
You lost all your records, though?
Everything.
So just, there must well, have been...
Well, fortunately, we had all our computer information backed up off-site.
Okay.
So that's what saved us. And, you know, the member firms were cooperative. If we needed to get another copy of the records and so on, they delivered and so on. But, you know, the exchange had us up and running within a couple of weeks with everything we needed to keep going. And then within a year, we had another 60,000 square feet of, you know, nice new office space across the street at 14 Wall. So, you know, they were supportive of the enforcement program. And resources weren't a problem, and no one was interfering with what we had to do. And I think that, you know, our program was really, the enforcement program was highly regarded by the SEC enforcement people and the oversight people and the member firm community, the legal folks there, and the outside bar. I think if you talk to them, they'll tell you that we had a first-class program. They knew what we were doing.
A fairly regular refrain from some is the whole idea of, well, they always go after the little guys, the big firms, mm-hmm. not so much. Was that something that you, you know, thought about and tried to counteract?
Yeah, we looked at, the answer is yes. One of the principal focuses of our program was firm and management responsibility for misconduct. You know, our view was that we can't do it all, the SEC can't do it all, and the member firms have to be the first line of defense in the self-regulatory process. And we felt that by holding the firms and management to a high degree of accountability for misconduct within the firm, now it's not strict liability, but we looked at those issues in every investigation. We looked at the supervisory issues and the management and firm responsibility issues in every investigation that we brought. The result was that in at least 25% of the cases we brought, those cases involved charges against either firms or management officials of firms, at least 25%.
Is this what's known as failure to supervise?
Well, yes. We looked at the supervisory issues, but sometimes instead of a supervisory charge, there's a substantive charge against the firm. So it wasn't always just a supervisory charge, but often a substantive charge, but it serves the same policy issue, which is to, by doing that, you hope to induce them to run a more disciplined business organization.
Sort of the opposite of what John Shad said, which is
blame people, not
the institution.
That's right. That's right. Okay. And you know, and when we brought cases, we tried to not just bring a case, but to fix the problem. So you know, we would often require firms to. And the SEC has done a lot of these things too, but we put, you know, independent directors on the board of directors. We required a lot of firms to have independent outside reviews done, to come in and look at their procedures and change the procedures where necessary. We've reallocated stocks from specialist firms and so on. So once we dealt with the problem going forward, we were hoping it would be fixed rather than, and we often tried to work that into a requirement of the settlement. So we, you know, we definitely were not into just going after the little guy. You know, mm-hmm.
Something that raises, you talked about how, you know, your jurisdiction was narrow and it was the mm-hmm. member firms. But you are companies, you know, you don't have to list companies.
Right.
So how much would you have been involved? Would enforcement or regulation have been involved with talking to companies or looking at standards for listing?
That wasn't our program. We enforced the 34 Act. You know, the listing agreements and so on were done on a whole other part of the exchange.
Okay. Yeah. I noticed when you were talking about the supervision, I noticed the failure to supervise seemed to be something that got kind of hot.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mid to late 90s. What was behind that?
Well, me largely. it was just my view that it isn't, you know, individuals go out and engage in misconduct, but within the context of the securities business, the firms have not only a statutory responsibility under the federal securities laws, but responsibility under our rules to supervise their business and run their business in compliance with the rules. And, you know, you could go around suing individuals all day long and you wouldn't accomplish much unless you look at the organization and the management of the organization. And for that reason, we really took that on as a is really one of the primary program areas that we
had. So in some sense, you talked about in the SEC that you were sitting around thinking about theories of, mm-hmm. and in some sense, you're doing the same thing here.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. No question.
I guess that's something enforcement people are going to do anyway.
Well, we probably carry it with us wherever we go. Right?
Okay.
But it really is, it's a way, you know, not just to get more bang. I mean, you do get more bang for the buck when you do that, but if your objective is to cause the member firm community to operate in compliance with the rules, you know, which then, of course, instills confidence in the marketplace and so on, you have to hold the, you know, the member firms and the management people accountable. As I say, it's not a strict liability thing, but it's they really have to do their jobs. And if they know they may be accountable, then, you know, they're more likely to get tough and run a tight ship.
Okay. Well, the last thing on my list is I want to walk through one of the last big sort of incidents, which would mm-hmm. have been the specialist firm issue. Mm-hmm. And talk a little bit about how that came up on your radar screen. I know there, again, you're talking about involving a lot of players.
Right.
And how
right,
that process right. worked itself out.
Well, of course, this was all related to activity on the floor of the exchange by the specialist firms. And, you know, I indicated that the exchange market surveillance people have all sort of computer programs that surveil trading and look for price gyrations and so on. And this stuff didn't kick out. My understanding is that the price differentials were, while it was vast, the price differentials were so small that the system didn't kick it out. Mm-hmm. And so the problems continued for some length of time, but it was discovered by, and I can't tell you exactly how, but a market surveillance analyst saw something suspicious, and then he looked further, and it became more suspicious. And when this was brought to the, you know, his management's attention, they were concerned and really cranked up a heavy-duty investigation.
Was Ed Falwasser doing that? Or no, he was Ed, a member of firms.
Well, no. By then, Ed had become head of the regulatory group.
Okay.
So I'm sure they ran it up to Ed, and they cranked up a big investigation, and I'm sure on this sort of thing, they probably alerted the SEC as
right.
well, which would be the practice. And then so a major investigation was conducted primarily on the market surveillance side. And then when it got to a certain point in terms of being advanced, then it got sent over to enforcement, and then we pursued it further and put all sorts of people on the case, and you know, I think I assigned 25 lawyers or something to it, and I mean, it was a...
What did you need to do that wasn't replicating what market surveillance had already done?
Well, we... It was an ongoing thing. I mean, it was really a major case. And we tend to take a lot of testimony, formal testimony and so on, much more so than they, to kind of nail down responsibility and so on. And then, of course, we were, you know, when we do investigations, we really relate on a major thing like this. We stick very close to the SEC and we work with them, and you know, sometimes they want to do something joint. Occasionally they want to take it. Sometimes we just keep them in the loop. And but on this one, it was, you know, a major case, and they were both the enforcement people and the oversight people were very much in the loop on how this developed.
SEC people?
SEC, yeah. Lori Richards and Steve Cutler. You know, it developed into, it was a major effort and developed into a major case. And ultimately the SEC was not happy with the way the exchange had managed the specialists, you know. So they brought a case against the exchange, you know, where the focus was really on the, you know, the market surveillance aspect of it, where this thing kind of got spawned. But it was a tough case. It was disappointing to see the sort of stuff had gone on.
The extent of what the specialists were doing.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, there was a major consequence to them, but it was surprising to see what had gone on and the, the length of time and so on.
That gets to one last really big sort of issue, which is the fact that, you know, the structure of the New York Stock Exchange was, it had been in place for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, having human beings as the intermediaries was, you know, looking old-fashioned.
Yeah.
And was there a sense that this system was approaching some significant change in the 90s? And was that feeding into the kinds of things that you saw happening as far as specialists and participants?
I think there probably was a sense that things were evolving, you know. But I don't see any connection between that and any misconduct on the floor.
Okay.
I guess I would just say in closing that I think one of the things I had always said to my people, and I think my people always felt they could go out and do what they had to do. You know, they weren't, you know, they had backup. We had their backs. They could be tough and, you know, talk to a director who was with a member firm and say, we're going to sue you, and so on. But I always said, look, you need to be tough, you need to be aggressive, you need to insist on timely compliance with your reasonable requests. But you also need to be fair. And I said, there's nothing inconsistent. I just want you to, there's nothing inconsistent with your going out there and being a tough enforcement person and being fair, and I expect you to do both. And that was really a theme that that we had in our program, and I think we ended up with a, you know, an effective and a vigorous enforcement program that, that had the respect of the community.
So there was some sense that there had to be balance.
Well, sure. I mean, you have to treat people fairly. In right. community. And that doesn't mean you can't be tough.
Right. Anything else that we should talk about?
I don't think so. I don't think so, Ken.
Well, we've got everything on my list. Terrific.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Good.